Jack Stephen Rauer, 14, passed away March 30, 2015, in McKinney, Texas. He was born June 15, 2000, at 8:26 p.m. in Dallas, Texas, to parents Jim and Rebecca Lagos Rauer. Jack, a freshman at Prosper High School, loved his school and his lifelong classmates. Jack's passion included watching his Vancouver Canucks with his dad, confiding and playfully conspiring with his best friend and sister, Sydney Kate. He idolized and looked up to his big brother, his bub man, Chris. Jack played right wing for McKinney Junior Varsity Gold, the squad, as Jack so lovingly referred to them, with his Prosper buddies. He enjoyed fishing and hunting, so many seasons, so many ducks. Jack's sense of humor was beyond his age, similar to his mother's. He wrote elaborate stories and brought joy to all around him. Jack also spent his days working diligently on his schoolwork, playing his heart out on the hockey rink and crashing out with his friends. Without a doubt, Jack positively touched the lives of countless people, and he will be forever etched in the loveliest places of our hearts. Another young man, Christian Anthony Tyler, 15, of McKinney, tragically passed away on August 26, 2016. He was the son of Bruce and Wendy Tyler and was born on September 29, 2000, in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Christian was an active member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, was a scout working towards his eagle. He was a junior at Prosper High School, where he was enrolled in the art and graphic design classes, subjects for which Christian had a great passion. With Christian's creative mind came a strong talent for drawing and an acute eye for detail. Christian spent many hours creating a portfolio of characters, ranging from dragons to people with space helmets. Although his strong point was on paper, his creativity didn't stop there. It was never a surprise when Christian's serious demeanor would be broken up by his quirks and hilarious sense of humor, even if it wasn't his intention. He always had a way of bringing a brighter light to those around him. Chandler William Federoff, 17, of Aubrey, Texas, a perpetually kind, intentionally silly teen who loved to make you laugh, passed away on May 30th, 2017. He was born on August 10th, 1999. William Eric Federoff and Kimberly Fry Blythe in Sherman, Texas. He will grow in adulthood under God's direct care with the help of lost loved ones who have greeted him at Heaven's Gate with love. Chandler had an infectious personality, always willing to sacrifice himself. He sought out others who needed a laugh or some reassurance. He was a best friend to everyone who knew him. He also had an incredible love for dogs, and especially his dog Puppers. Chandler had a passion for music from a very young age. He started learning his craft at Lakeview Middle School in The Colony, Texas. He developed into an outstanding musician in percussion, playing many instruments but focusing on marimba and snare drum. He has received numerous awards and honors, including being a member of Honor Band of America, Indianapolis, Indiana. Chandler was a member of the Colony High School drumline for 3 years. He then transferred to Prosper High School, where he was a member of the Prosper High School drumline, the Mighty Eagle Steel Drum Band. And finally here, Braden Thomas Speed, age 18, of Prosper, Texas, passed away in the arms of his Heavenly Father on Tuesday morning, August 30th, 2018. He was born at dawn on May 9th, 2000, in College Station, Texas, the beloved son of Kathy Speed and Mark Speed. Braden moved his family from College Station to Katy, Austin, and returning again to Katy before settling in Prosper 2014. Braden attended Reynolds Middle School and Prosper High School, participating in band and academic programs. Braden looked forward to graduating and had recently changed his educational goals from architectural engineering to child teen psychology. He would have been outstanding in the field where he had great passion. And all four of these obituaries ended in one thing. All said they left behind friends, family, cousins, brothers, sisters, grandparents, parents. All of them had that in common. They're all loved dearly, it said in each one of their obituaries. So I read you these four obituaries of these four young men who all coincidentally attended the same high school, Prosper High School in Texas. So what do these three seemingly happy, healthy, successful young men with bright and beautiful futures have in common? All four decided their lives were not worth living anymore and were in a perpetual state of despair and unhappiness, leading to them prematurely taking their lives through suicide. All four of them. 14-year-old Jack Rauer, 15-year-old Christian Tyler, 17-year-old Chandler Fedoroff, 18-year-old Braden Speed. From an article November 11, 2019, in the Dallas News entitled, "After Four Students Died by Suicide at Prospero High School, Here's How the District Responded," members of what is known as the Hope Squad are talking candidly about mental health and suicide, seeking out lonely and troubled students and making referrals to school counselors. So far, squad members have flagged 25 at-risk teens. Tony Cooper, the high school's Hope Squad advisor, shared a conversation that one girl had with his team members that included this troubling cry: "I don't feel good enough. Not good enough for me or my parents." That's the pressure a lot of Prosper kids feel, Cooper told them. Why, in a time of knowledge, of seemingly abundance, lots of discovery, things have seemingly going great, you live in a country with boundless opportunities, seemingly people who love them, families who love them, people who cared for them, why would these four young men feel hopelessly despair? Why are so many others experiencing the same feelings? It's a question that I've started asking myself as I've seen more and more of these kind of things in headlines and hearing more. So today, I hope to give you information about a national epidemic facing our country and call on all of us in this church, to begin thinking about how we can take action. So the title is this: The Clarion Call for Our Generation. Subtitle: The Church of God Must Act. Probably have heard, or maybe have heard, the saying, "You only live once." YOLO. I know some people abbreviate it, right? YOLO. I'm living my best life. I've heard these sayings kind of on and off for the last couple of years, last few years. I know some kind of trending all the time, more and more and more. People want people saying these kind of things. And I've noticed it mostly in probably the millennial generation and younger, maybe a little bit in the Generation X, but I'm really starting to notice it in the vernacular of what I've said, the younger generation, and I mean 40 and under at this point. We're seeing more and more programs in schools addressing bullying. You may have heard of the program called Be Nice. Nice meaning notice, invite, challenge, and empower. Notice, invite, challenge, and empower. All programs that didn't exist when I was in school, and probably when several people here didn't have them in school, except for maybe the ones that are in school now. The issue isn't isolated to high school kids. This is the thing about it. It's not isolated to just high school kids. It's college kids, even. College kids are experiencing it. And also Air Force personnel, believe it or not. I have a friend who's been in the Air Force, and I've been out of high school 19 years now. And he's kind of towards the end of his time. So he's reached the point in the rank of, I think, Master Sergeant or something like that. And he's pretty far up, and he's in charge of many young men. Typically, people don't last 20 years in the military. You get out after 4, maybe 8 years, and that's it. But he's signed up for the whole long 20 years. So he's got a lot of young men, and there's a common friend of ours that posted an article about how people in the Air Force, the young people, are committing suicide at an alarming rate. My comment was, why is this happening, on this post? And his response was, and I didn't even think about it, I forgot that he was been in the Air Force this long, his response was, "I wish I knew. I'm in charge of a lot of these young men." It's bothering him. He had no answers. So we're seeing with high school, college, military personnel who typically are younger, 18 to 22 years of old age, maybe 26 at the with the oldest and the average age. So in an article from ABC News entitled, "Rising Suicide Rates at College Campuses Prompt Concerns Over Mental Health Care, Suicide Rates Continuing to Increase Across All Age Groups in America." I'll read a couple of excerpts from this article I found. "Suicide rates continue to increase across all age groups in America, but the rising youth suicide epidemic, which has progressively increased since the 1950s, I'll stop here a second. Last week I gave this sermon in Kalamazoo. Someone came up to me and actually did their master thesis on this very thing. And noticed that in the 1950s, there was a spike in suicides also about the time that television came out. His theory was is that it has to do with people socializing and connecting with each other. So going back to 1950s, it been increasingly progressively since the 1950s. It's particularly concerning among those who study it. Suicide is the 10th leading cause of death across the U.S. population, and it was the second leading cause of death among young Americans age 15 to 24. We are facing a national mental health crisis, and college campuses are reflecting what's going on in society at large, Victor Schwartz, chief medical officer of the Jed Foundation, said. It's a nonprofit that aims to prevent suicides among young people. Dr. Dorian Marshall, vice president of programs at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, agreed. We hear from college and university counseling centers, they are seeing more students coming in reporting that they have some current or past suicidal ideation, which is a signal that this is a time that students are really struggling. According to the CDC, suicide rates across all ages increased in nearly every state between 1999 and 2016. And suicide rates went up more than 30% in half of states since 1999. Independent of college, statistics reveal a spike in suicidality between the ages of 15 and 25. Again, that same age group. Until the age of 25, rational thinking and the ability to regulate emotions, impulses, are still developing. If you can remember when you were a teenager and young person, you slowly but surely are becoming more and more independent, aren't you, at those ages? Less and less are you dependent on your parents, more you want to handle things yourself. It gets a little tougher, and then all of a sudden, at the age of 18, we tend to kick kids out the door and go to college or whatever. They're all on their own, and sometimes at college with a bunch of people just as rational as they are at the age of 18 and 19. Sounds like just a beautiful recipe, doesn't it? Similar statistic was cited on PBS.org entitled "Youth Suicide Rates Are on the Rise in the U.S." Between 2000 and 2007, the suicide rate among youth ages 10 to 24 hovered around 6.8 deaths per 100,000 people. Then the rate curved upward, reaching a rate of 10.6 deaths per 100,000 by 2017, a 56% increase in less than two decades. Hope you can see through these statistics, there's something going on here. Just not a coincidence. This isn't just a blip, something that just, wow, what's going on? This will go away eventually. Doesn't look like it. From goodrx.com, Before I read that, I started wondering what generally leads up to that. Depression and anxiety normally are some of the recipes for it. So I wondered if there was a correlation between the prescription drugs being prescribed for mental support. And sure enough, there was, actually. And this is from GoodRx. It says depression and anxiety prescriptions are climbing nationwide. So just like the Northeast, it says, the Midwest also has seen high fill rates for depression and anxiety medications. Throughout the year, depression and anxiety medications account for 7.3% of all fills in the Midwest. And that rate has only continued to increase. According to prescription fills, Midwestern states like North Dakota, Minnesota, and Iowa experienced the highest rates of fills for anxiety and depression medications in the country. What's more, compared to all the other regions, the Midwest has seen the fastest increase in fills for depression and anxiety medications since 2015, with fill rates increasing over 12%. Just like the Northeast, seasonal affective disorder could be leading to higher rates of anxiety and depression in the Midwest. Question they have here, though, in the article is, why do the fills continue to remain high throughout the summer? As we can see, we're starting to get out of the doldrums of winter, the gray skies. We're seeing a beautiful sunny day here in Michigan. And that's going to continue on through summer and early fall, presumably. And yet, prescription drugs continue to be on the rise. People are still having more and more issues with anxiety and depression. So the question I had after I learned all this, why? So we know what's going on, but why is it happening? Our youth are experiencing massive changes in behavior right now. Some of it leading to suicide, prescription drugs for anxiety, and I would say even changes in marital habits you're starting to see within our young folks quite often. So interesting enough, the youth of generation have also changed their behaviors related to marriage, and I thought for sure I was going to see a correlation between higher divorce rates and also a combination of that with all these suicides and everything. What I did find was no, the divorce rates have not been climbing with this age group. Actually, have been coming down with this age group. Some other reasons for that, we'll get into that as time goes on. But the average age for a man now getting married and a woman is 30 and 28. 30 and 28. It's quite a bit older than it used to be, right? Those who are marrying tend to be college educated and have their career stabilized and do not have children out of wedlock. So the people who are getting married have their act together, in other words. The people who aren't getting married tend to have the more issues in life right now are the ones who are at near poverty, are living together with someone else, have children with them, potentially, and they're at a much younger age doing this. If they do get married, they have a 50% chance they're going to get divorced. That's the age, that's the population that's the biggest issue. If you generally have what I would say, you have your act together, you're at closer to a 20% divorce rate. It's 30% difference. It's pretty significant, from 20 to 50. So that's something that's interesting to me is that, okay, so there's lower divorce rates, but there's also some other things associated with that. I was doing some research for this sermon. The thing that came out was that the number, and this is from fatherly.com, the number of unmarried adults is at a record high 20%. 20% of all adults are not married. According to a 2014 Pew Research Center report, in 1960, 68% of 20-somethings, 20 to 29 obviously, were married. 68%. In 2008, that number was only 26%, 12 years ago. When they looked at this number, only 12 years ago, 26% were married. An earlier Pew poll revealed that 39% of respondents said marriage is now obsolete. Now, in the last 12 years, do you think those numbers have gotten any better? Less people are married. Much smaller percentage of people are married in their 20s. And they're now feeling that marriage is obsolete. So the family unit, mom and dad, these kind of things, are now changing quite a bit. The family unit that God envisioned, the mom and dad and children that he wanted to have just after himself, is changing. It went on to continue to say this in its new study. University of Maryland sociologist Philip N. Cohen used data from the CDC's American Community Survey, which began collecting information about marriage and divorce in 2008, to determine that the proportion of married women who divorce each year dropped 18% in the past decade. All of that decline was among women under 45 years old. So generally under 45. Again, this younger age group. One of the biggest problems with national divorce averages is that they only include baby boomers. So that's the big problem. They include baby boomers. A group that statistically is very prone to divorce, it says here. One reason why is they divorce a lot is that they get married a lot. Boomers, that is people born between 1946 and around 1964. Generally married young, which this says is a contributor to divorce risk. Researchers, however, are starting to tease out the differences among the different age groups. Then divorce rates, it goes on and wraps up here, divorce rates are dropping, goes against conventional wisdom. Cohen wrote in a blog about his research between 1960 and 80 that the crude divorce rate went from 2.2 to 5.2, an increase of 136%, which inspired some freaking out about the disillusion of the American family. So what we see is that a big generation of people did divorce a lot, and it's changing, but now we have even more this same young group of young people who are struggling with depression, anxiety, all these other things in life, are choosing not to get married. So they're changing what their lives would look like greatly. So that leads to my next part of this sermon, is that there's a change in the family unit. There's a change in the family unit as we begin to look at the information about why a whole generation of people are having issues. So you all tend to think of a family as dad and mom, and you got your 2.3 kids or whatever the number is, you know, at one time, and we call that, you know, the family unit, right? And that's kind of a rather modern view of family if you look at thousands of years. And now we're starting to look at it that it's even changing more drastically, where you have all kinds of different looks of a family. You have mom and a dad and a stepmom and a stepdad, and then you have these step siblings and maybe a half siblings, and it's what you call, there's the modern family, right? There's even a show called Modern Family out there, which if you've ever seen it or even read about it, it's pretty bad if that's what a real family looks like. But this change in the family unit has been going on for years and years and generations and decades for a while now, and probably well over 100 years this change in the family unit has been taking place. Think about the nuclear family, and that's the mom, the dad, and your kids, okay? Well, one morning, I was waking up and just going through some news articles on my phone, and I saw one titled, "The Nuclear Family Was a Mistake." The Nuclear Family Was a Mistake by David Brooks. And my initial reaction was, how dare he? You know, he's going after God. And I, you know, so instantly defensive, and I started reading it just out of spite. I'm going to see what this guy's got to say about all this. Interesting enough, I ended up finding as I read it, the guy has a lot of valid points that I didn't think. So sometimes, as good articles have, they have a way of roping you in to make you read it, and then you get stuck reading it. A couple things he says in it. According to Ruggles, in 1800, 90% of American families were corporate families. Now, a corporate family is this. It's kind of your extended family. It's a clan-style family, right? Mom and dad, kids, grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, right? You're an extended family, a group, clan-style, right? We're corporate families. Until 1850, roughly three-quarters of Americans older than 65 lived with their kids and grandkids. Nuclear families existed, but they were surrounded by extended or corporate families. So the nuclear family, mom, dad, the kids, were there, but they're supported by this vast network of family around them at all times. The extended families have two great strengths, he says. The first is resilience. An extended family is one or more families in a supporting web. Your spouse and children come first, but there are also cousins, in-laws, grandparents, a complex web of relationships among, say, 7, 10, or 20 people. If a mother dies, siblings, uncles, and aunts and grandparents are there to step in. If a relationship between a father and child ruptures, others can fill the breach. Extended families have more people to share the unexpected burdens. When a kid gets sick in the middle of the day, or when an adult unexpectedly loses a job. You see it now. How often you see someone lose their job, families start falling apart, income goes away, the house goes, all of a sudden parents end up divorcing. It's just kind of the spiral network, right? Whereas these corporate families, as he writes about in here, support each other. You have a financial downturn, there's other people lift you back up till you get back on your feet. It's a very supportive group to help you through these times. And what we have right now, as we're about to find out, we don't have that anymore. The burden has fallen straight on everyone's own shoulders. It says a detached nuclear family, by contrast, is an intense set of relationships among, say, four people. If one relationship breaks, there are no shock absorbers. In a nuclear family, the end of the marriage means the end of the family as was previously understood. Several years ago, probably going back 10, well, more than that, yeah, maybe 10 years, I was at the Feast of Tabernacles, and they had a seminar on marriage and family. So I attended it. And the question was asked by the presenter of the Bible study or the seminar was, what's the most important part of the family? What's the most important part of the family? And as you're sitting here thinking about it, a lot of times we're programmed to say the kids. The kids are the most important part of it. It's not right. It's incorrect. Mom and dad are. Mom and dad are the central part of the family. Without mom and dad there is no family. When mom and dad are doing well, everyone's doing well. So when the family breaks apart because mom and dad are no longer together, you have no family. And that's why you have so much stress from a group of people who were raised by the baby boomers, had the highest divorce rates, and they have started to have no use for marriage because, hey, it didn't work for mom and dad. It's obsolete. They're under stress the whole time. Jobs went away. They're under stress financially. Why in the world would I want to be part of something that was so stressful for my parents? And that's what you're starting to see is this kind of combination. It's starting to play out over the course of several years now. It's starting to catch up with us as a society. It goes on to say this, by the 1920s, the nuclear family, with the male breadwinner, had replaced the corporate family as the dominant family form. By 1960, 77.5% of all children were living with their two parents who were married and apart from their extended families, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, right? A lot of times people move for a job, and you think of it during the Great Depression, people left their family farms or wherever they were doing, went into the bigger cities to find jobs. It's also about the same time we saw the advent of electricity coming into homes, and people couldn't have it out in rural America, so they wanted to have electricity, so they were moving into more urban centers, which meant they were leaving their extended family to pursue these jobs and careers and other things. More higher, I guess, class of living. Today, only a minority of American households are traditional two-parent nuclear families. And only one-third of American individuals live in this kind of family. That 1950 to 65 window was not normal. 1950 to 1965 is when he says that was kind of the heyday of the nuclear family. My dad was born in 1958, right in the middle of that time period, the heyday of it. Although his parents were divorced, he still lived and enjoyed a lot of the benefits of that era where you had a lot of tight-knit nuclear families living in a lot of common areas. He talked about he'd leave the house all day and go and play and not have an issue. The street lights would come on. That was time to go home. He'd play all day. Maybe come back to get food, maybe not. So that was kind of his heyday. And he grew up in St. Joe. And if you've been to St. Joe, Michigan, it's kind of down below the bluff. There's a bunch of homes and different types of dwelling. And he lived down there at the time. So it was a lot of fun for him. And there's no issues. Again, this is the heyday of it. Hearing him describe it, it sounded very nice. Goes on to say, for another thing, nuclear families in this era were much more connected to other nuclear families that are today than they are today. Constituting a modified extended family, as the sociologist Eugene Litwick calls it, a coalition of nuclear families in a state of mutual dependence. Even as late as the 1950s, before television and air conditioning had fully caught on, people continue to live on one another's front porches and were part of one another's lives. Friends felt free to discipline one another's children. You think about that. People did live on each other's porches. You know, if you wanted to talk to somebody, you'd have, you know, and just spend time with a glass of lemonade on a warm day, you got out of your house, right? Well, that era doesn't happen anymore, does it? People don't sit on their front porches. They sit privately on their back decks if they do have one and don't talk to anybody, right? Time to, you know, walk up down the street and you see, you know, something like the Andy Griffith Show, and you'd walk up and there's Goober walking up to sit down and they'd pick a guitar, right, and drink some lemonade. Well, that was the era he's talking about. People had a mutual dependence on each other, supported each other. It's a different time, and it worked. It worked really well for these small families that no longer had the benefit of their extended family around them. They depended on each other. In his book, The Lost City, the journalist Alan Ehrenhalt, describes life in mid-century Chicago and suburbs. So he kind of gives you a picture here of what it was like. And To be a homeowner in a suburb like Elmhurst in the 1950s was to participate in a communal enterprise that only the most determined loner could escape. Barbecues, coffee clutches, volleyball games, babysitting co-ops, and constant bartering of household goods, child rearing by the nearest parents who happened to be around, neighbors wandering through the door at any time, any hour without knocking. All these were devices by which young adults who had been set down in a wilderness to tract homes and made a community. It was a life lived in public. So you think about the show, see the shows, go over and ask Mrs. Smith for a cup of sugar, right? You know, go get this from them. And people shared things and supported each other. Now it just doesn't happen. It doesn't happen that way anymore. You know, you see it in some neighborhoods, kids out playing and having a good time, but you know, you don't really see those people sitting and really talking about life with each other like, you know, you see and hear about all this. Just wrapping up here, it says, in short, the period from 1950 to 65 demonstrated that a stable society can be built around nuclear families so long as women are relegated to the household. Nuclear families were so intertwined that they were basically extended families by another name, and every economic and sociological condition of society is working together to support the institution. And from that time period on, you saw a decline, right? It went really well. Incomes were really high per capita. Father having a job was enough to support the whole family. Mom could stay home, make sure the household was taken care of really well. Stress was pretty low key overall. And as time went on, incomes have dropped compared to expenses. Expenses have risen. Incomes have not kept up with the rate of inflation. And now mom and dad both have to work. And it's changed a lot of things and how the family units went on. So I see it this way. I see three parts. You start with what we call the clan style or the extended family. And then you move on to what we call the nuclear family. And now I say we're in the era of the dysfunctional family. The dysfunctional family. Looked up the definition of dysfunctional, just for the fun of it. This was an interesting definition. It's not really a definition. They actually, if you look at Merriam-Webster, they actually have sometimes a history of a word. How did it come into our vocabulary? How did we start using it on a regular basis? And dysfunction is kind of a common word now. It says here, dysfunctional and dysfunction have been used for almost 100 years, often in medical writing, brain dysfunction, dysfunctional liver, but also by social scientists, a dysfunctional city council. Diplomatic dysfunction. But they only really entered into the general vocabulary in the 1980s when therapists and talk show hosts began talking about dysfunctional families. The signs of family dysfunction turned out to be numerous, and it soon began to seem as if pretty much all families could be called dysfunctional. This was the 1980s. So we had kind of the era where the baby boomers were born, and then all of a sudden they became parents. They started having kids. Life got stressful for a lot of reasons for them because they didn't have the income. They didn't have these modern networks that you read about in the 50s and 60s. And it was all on mom and dad to succeed, and it was so stressful. They were collapsing. Divorce was happening. And all of a sudden, you started seeing more and more dysfunction popping up in our family units. Think about this for a moment. If you can remember the 80s and 90s, I went back and did a little search about what some of the best or top shows in the 80s and 90s were. Think about it. These are the ones that portrayed family units. They're portraying family units in the 80s and 90s. It was The Simpsons. Talk about dysfunction, right? How about this one? Married with Children. Al Bundy. Al Bundy is a model father, right? Talk about major dysfunction there, right? Al and Peg Bundy, right? And then the final one I have on this list, and there's a lot of them there, you could go on. Roseanne. I mean, and it was somewhat less dysfunctional and more functional than Married with Children, and you can't help but be. But people would look at those shows and laugh, and they would enjoy it, And they'd say, at least I'm not as bad as them, right? We're not as bad as that family. Or they'd be, wow, that's kind of like our family. We're kind of normal, you know, which isn't good if you're looking at the Bundys, right? But compare that with the shows of the 50s and 60s and maybe even early 70s, Leave It to Beaver. Andy Griffith Show, My Three Sons. Go back and you watch those shows, and the dad was respected and was a good leader of his home. There's a mother or a female figure in the show. She's to be revered and respected. Kids were respectful, not out of line. You think of the difference between that era and now. What a change. What a change. Shows like Modern Family are now really cool to watch. You think about how entertainment reflects society, and you start seeing that we have changed a lot. We have changed more than we realize because we've been slowly in the pot and the heat's been turning up. It's been turning up a lot. You know, Brooks went on to talk about how his solution was that you need to bring back these kind of modern communals where people depend on each other. And they didn't work. You know, they didn't last. They didn't last forever because you're not a family. Once things change, once your job goes away, you go away. If anyone's ever been part of a job place or had neighbors, generally after people leave the job or they move out of the neighborhood, you sort of keep up with them, but then eventually you don't. And you're not family. Just not going to keep up with people. And who knows if the next people come in and you're going to get along with them. It's always a jack-in-the-box when you get new neighbors, right? But he talked about that as an answer. The problem is, it doesn't work. You need to have an agreeable set of laws, values, a way of living. You know, the Church of God is a family. And it works if you agree to abide by God's biblically prescribed way of life. We've all seen the church kind of fall apart. People go their own ways when they don't agree to abide by their own way of life. They put their own personal agendas above somebody else's. I'm more important than this group of people, so I'm going to get my way or I'm going to leave. They don't see themselves as a family unit. They see themselves as an individual, and that changes everything. The pressure for being a family has been at its greatest point. It's at its greatest point. The heat's been turned up on mom and dad. It was started being turned up since the 1950s and 60s, as I've said. Mom and dad are stressed out. They're unhappy. Again, like I said before, the children see it and share in that stress. They argue. Things like that just continue to pile up on these children. And then even grandma and grandpa aren't there to help because a lot of times grandma and grandpa are having to work later and later in life too. So the stresses and pressures start piling on. Family unit's not there anymore. And then all of a sudden you say, we're going to make it even better. 2008, 2009, 2010, we started making social and digital media readily available to adolescents who don't have the social or emotional ability to deal with it. We're starting to see the recipe for a generational disaster here, aren't we? It's been slowly taking place over time. And you know, Satan doesn't have a time period. So I've been around for a long time. I'm going to be around long after these people are here. I'm going to slowly work on these group of people. And I'm going to attack the one thing that God designed, which was the family unit. I'm going to attack it. I'm going to put stress on it. And it's going to start falling apart. You think during the same era of the heyday of the nuclear family, people went to church as a family. It was common. It was normal. You went to church. You're part of a church. You believed in God. Or at least if you didn't really strongly do it, you at least went through the actions. You went through the parts of it. You at least was there participating in some way, fashion, or form. Now people don't go to church. You have what's called C&E Christians, Christmas and Easter. Even the Church of God's even has that a little bit with the holy days, right? Where you have people that you see maybe on the holy days. Don't attend church regularly. And a lot of times they wonder why their life's so stressful. Here's some statistics I wanted to show you about the decline of God in America. And I did a seminar, and I know some of you might have been there. I think you were there, right, for that seminar and been able to participate in it or at least listen. Here's some statistics about the decline of God in America. So a Gallup poll published in April 2019, only half of Americans are members of a church now. Only half. 50% of Americans, that we're up over 300 million, are part of a church. Some type of membership. That's down from 70% in 1999. 70% of Americans in 1999 were part of a church. 21 years. Of course, this is 20 years here. Most of the decline is attributable to increase in the percentage of people identifying with no religion, and membership has fallen 9 points among those who are religious. Church membership has fallen. People's belief in God is changing. It says here, U.S. church membership was 70% or higher from 1937 through 1976. 7% or higher. So this is, again, during that heyday of what a nuclear family was, church membership was at its highest point when they were measuring it. Really going well. And then it began to fall, falling to an average of 68%. Not much, though. Only 2 percentage points did it fall through 1970s through 1990s, and it rose temporarily in 1999 to 70% again. And you remember the Y2K? You know, everyone was worried and afraid and didn't know what was going to happen. Is it going to be utter chaos? Get your fallout kits put together in your fallout rooms, right? Everybody remember that? We don't know if power is ever going to come back on again. Turned out it did. It worked out all right. But people were afraid. And generally that drives people back into church again when they're afraid. Nervous. Need answers. Well, God might have them for you. Well, I guess, you know, after everything worked out, we'll start not attending church again. It says here the past 20 years have seen a precipitous fall with a 20 percentage point decline since 1999. So God made sure we got through Y2K. He's got it under control. I don't need to be back in church anymore. And more than half of that change occurring since 2010. Now let's start putting some things together real quick. Since 1999, belief in God has been changing. Generation of people are starting to come of age from a divorced-ridden society. They're starting to have families of their own, or not participating in family in a lot of cases. Same time, we're seeing in that same 20-year time period, suicides are up. And especially, it says, in the last 10 years, we've seen the biggest drop and the fastest drop in the belief of God, or at least church membership. And what else did we see? The highest rate and acceleration of suicides and anxiety medication being prescribed. And then it goes on here, one last thing. It says, since the turn of the century, the percentage of U.S. adults with no religious affiliation has more than doubled from 8 to 19%. So what we have is a formula for anxiety and hopelessness. We don't have God. We don't have a family. The whole thing's falling apart. The two most strongest points you should have in your life is God, your belief in God, your faith in a greater being, and your family to help you in the here and now, and people don't have either one of them. And now you're starting to see why we're starting to have issues in this country and around the world. With this formula, you know, we have a generation of people who don't have respect for God, the family, don't want to have children of their own, don't want to bring children in this world for whatever reason, don't want to have a family of their own, do not know God, and couldn't tell you the difference between 1 Timothy and 2 Nathaniel. There is no 2 Nathaniel, right? But they wouldn't be able to tell you that. You could say, turn to 2 Nathaniel and start getting on their books and flipping through the pages. And it's not there. That's because it's you only live once society. Living my best life. If I can't have happiness now, forget the whole thing. I'm going to go find it somewhere else. And you start having the thing fall apart slowly but surely. And it's affecting the children. It's affecting kids who need the stability in this time of the most drastic change for them. When they're getting cut loose into this world, we're saying we give you nothing but instability at the same time. What is mankind's purpose? Was it to become part of this stressed out, crazy society? There's a lot of people wondering that. There's a lot of people wondering that. Turn to Romans 8. Romans 8. This is our first scripture of this sermon. This is if you're in speech club, it would have been called get the facts speech, right? What we're doing today is getting the facts about what's going on in society. But we'll also turn to Romans 8, verse 16. Romans 8, 16. The Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs of God, and joint heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified together. Why was I born? I bet Jack Stephen Rauer, Christian Anthony Tyler, Chandler William Federoff, and Braden Thomas Speed all asked this question over and over and over again before they made the decision to finally take their life. They thought their life was utterly worthless, without value. They didn't know that they were the very sons and daughters of the great and highest God. They didn't know it. Didn't realize the value of their life and why they were here on this planet. They also didn't know that they were made in the very image of the great God in heaven. Genesis 1, turn there, Genesis 1. Genesis 1:26. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him male and female, he created them. Both man and woman created in God's image. Look at your hand. God has a hand just like it. Five fingers, or if you want to be really particular, four fingers and a thumb. Five toes, foot, knee, bipedal, walk on two legs, right? It's the way God is made, and he made us just like him because we are his children. Our children look like us. It's because we look like God. And that's important for us to remember that as we're living in this life, that God created us to be his sons and daughters, to bring us into the glory with him, that we can last forever. Becoming a parent teaches you more than you know about God. So many things I've encountered since becoming a parent, and I've now learned about God so much by that experience. The amount of love and grace and joy that he has for us that I never understood before I wasn't a parent, and now I do. And I can't imagine how painful it is for those parents of those four boys to lose their kids. But then God, on top of it, to lose it, to have it happen every day, over and over again. You are a miracle. Every one of you are. One of the biggest things we discount as human beings is the great amount of work that went into you and me and all human beings coming into life and being who you are and not someone else. You are a true miracle. So many variables exist when it comes to life being created. And it started with God fashioning us in his very image. Then it goes on to Adam and Eve, having the right amount, the number of children. I think if they had maybe one less or one more, it might change everything. I don't know. But they had the right number of children. And then their children had the right number of children. And then their children had the right number of children. And it goes on and on for thousands of years. My mom and her twin sister are number 6 and 7. Of 10 kids, number 6 and 7. And their direct oldest sibling is exactly 12 months, 365 days older than them. They share the same birthday, just 1 year apart. So 3 months into having their fifth child, having a three-month-old child, they conceive my mom and her twin sister, number 6 and 7. So not only do they have a one-year-old, so anybody who has had children knows this, they had twins also. And then they had a whole bunch of older kids running around too. And if that wasn't good enough, they went on and had three more after that. What if my grandparents stopped at one kid, at two, three, at four? What if they said, you know what, we just had a one-year-old and this is our fifth child. Let's wait a year or two and have our next one. What if they said that? Not only would my mom and aunt not exist, I wouldn't be here. My brother wouldn't be here. My two cousins from my aunt wouldn't be here. And our seven kids now wouldn't be here. Think about that a little bit. Start thinking about numbers. You don't have to be a numbers genius to think about the odds of all of these things happening to bring just me into existence and my children. These same odds are for you also. Now, to put this in perspective, that was my mom's side of the family. Let's talk about my dad real quick, my dad's side of the family. My dad's mom, my grandmother, was the 10th of 10 children. The 10th of 10 children. It wasn't like it was the two oldest, you know, and it was bound for me to be here, you know. I mean, the odds of everything happening are crazy if you really think about it. My grandma had the philosophy, my great-grandma had a philosophy, there's always room for more. And I'm glad she had that philosophy, by the way. Because again, if they would have stopped at 3 or 4 or 5 or 7 or 9, I wouldn't be here. She wouldn't have been here. My dad wouldn't be here. Things would be so much different, wouldn't it? At least I hope it would be. Think about this. If my parents waited about 4 years to have me. They're fairly young. My mom was 18. My dad was 20. They waited 4 years to have me. What if they waited just one more month? What if they said 2 years is long enough, we'll start having children? Would have changed everything. Would have changed everything. And you can start getting into this, the sheer odds of everything's happening, but it's craziness. Things came together just at the right time to create you, to create your unique DNA strand that identifies you. There's none other out there, unless you're an identical twin like my mom. But then that's even different. You know, even if you know my mom and her sister, you can know, even as identical DNA, they're still different people. God even allows there to be some variations even deeper into it that we can't figure out. Here's some information I wanted to read you. I just love the way they summed it up. It's from Dr. Ali Benarzi. Imagine there was a life preserver thrown somewhere in the ocean. All the massive oceans. Just one life preserver just tossed randomly out there. And there's exactly one turtle, one sea turtle out there in the big massive ocean. I think 70% of the world's covered in water, right? Tells you how big the ocean is. There's trillions and trillions and trillions of gallons, and I can't even tell you how many there probably is. Someone's done the numbers. The probability that you came about and exist today is the same as that turtle sticking its head out of the water in the middle of that life preserver on the first try. Get your head wrapped around that, for instance. You ever seen how big the ocean is? Throw a life preserver out there. Some turtle randomly out there is going to just happen to stick its head right through that as it comes up for oxygen. The path begins, it says here, the path begins with the odds of your dad and mom meeting, 1 in 20,000. This is multiplied by a chance of them staying together long enough to have kids, 1 in 2,000. And so on and so on. The probability of you existing at all comes out to be 1 in 10 to the 2 millionth, 685,000th power. Think about that for a moment. Yes, that's 10, followed by 2,685,000 zeros. Dr. Benazir concludes that the odds of you being alive are basically zero. Mere fact, you're sitting in this room today alive is a complete miracle of an existence. You being who you are, with your own flaws, with your own unique abilities, your own ways of doing things, is completely unique to you and you only. Do you think if we all looked at each other as the true miracles that we really are, and you think about that no one could ever even dream of creating you because it's the odds are just crazy to think of you being who you are. You can't sit down and even describe to try to paint it or create it. I think if we really thought about us as the masterpieces we are, that we might have a lot more respect for each other. The next time you start getting mad at somebody or hating somebody, you start thinking about just how special that person is. Even if they make you mad, the mere fact that they exist is a true miracle. You think we'd have a lot more love and respect if we started doing that? I think so. I think we'd treat each other a lot differently if we started looking at life that way. Especially if you're a young person. I know we have a teenager in this room here. We have even someone younger than her. Your generation matters. You matter. You're loved, you're needed. Your existence to this world matters. And that's something we need to be remembering, is that the young people of this world came into this world not asking. They didn't ask to come into this world, but they're here. And so we have a purpose as a church. So in conclusion, turn to Matthew 28:18. Matthew 28:18. And Jesus came and spoke to them, saying, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son, now the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things that I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of age." We have a commission. We have a mission. We have a job to do that was given to the church. To respond. To make disciples. To bring people into the glory of God. We have a job. I'm not naive. I realize life can be tough. And at times it can bring you to your knees, as Rocky Balboa told his son in Rocky. You know, I know personally about how dark and despair our minds can become. I, too, have become part of the group of people who have experienced anxiety and depression. I worked through it. About 3 years ago, I had that kind of coming over me about several things that happened in my life at the time. And I started allowing myself to go into this dark, bad place. And it's hard to turn your mind off when you start going into that place, if anyone's ever been there. It's hard to climb out of it. It's hard to get your head back into a right space. No one else really knows. If you're really good at it, you can kind of walk through the motions, and people don't know all the things that's going through your mind. When you go into fight or flight mode and all these kind of things, your mind just goes weird places and the mental anguish doesn't go away easy. For me, what helped me, as a matter of fact, there was actually a sermonette that was given about someone going through the same thing and helping them go through it. That helped me. That was kind of the first step that, you know, I need to start taking some proactive steps to fix this in my own head. What helped me was knowing God personally, being part of the church family. I had the maturity. I was older. I was 33 at the time. I had the maturity, the experience, the family, the knowledge of God that pulled me through that. A lot of times a younger person doesn't have that. Someone who might not have the ability to really pull themselves up by the bootstraps, as they say, might not have the ability to get through those tough times. I'm glad I went through it. I wouldn't want to go through it again. I learned a lot going through that experience. And it gives me the ability to relate to people who have been there. Every experience I've had, whether it's going having a bad back, which I had earlier this year, or whatever I might have had, I've had other health issues, as a lot of you know. Now I'm healthy, I feel great. But now I have this new compassion for people who have been in these different situations. We have a responsibility as members of God's church to act on this great commission we've been given by us, by Jesus Christ to us. We need to help a generation of people who grew up not knowing the Almighty God, maybe not having a really healthy home life, or not knowing the true worth of their life and the beautiful future we all have in front of us. I challenge not only the Church of God, I specifically challenge this congregation right here in West Michigan. Let's accept a clarion call to action and begin changing lives and giving people an extended family to help them cope with this world. And let's help bring many sons and daughters to glory.